FM. From Machaneh Ramah in the Berkshires, this is Parsha Talk. I'm Rabbi Elie Melamed. With me, Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanowski, Rabbi Barry Chesler. Gentlemen, shalom.
Shalom, bracha.
Shalom.
We have a double Parsha this Shabbat, Matot Maseh. We're concluding the book of Bamidbar. Before we jump into these Parshiot, just tell us where we've been and where we're going. What does this endpoint mean in the entire story? We'll start with you, Rabbi Chesler.
So, Bamidbar, in large measure, is a record of failure, revolt, death. Aaron and Miriam both die in this book. Joshua is appointed, but does not yet take over the reins of power. A lot of bad things have happened to Bnei Yisrael. There's been a lot of complaining. And yet, there's a note of triumph at the end of the book. The Israelites fight a victorious battle in which no one from their side is killed. There's a lot of spoil that is divided up successfully.
Is it a matter of triumph that they just make it? Is it that they made it?
Well, I think you get the sense that they've been battle-hardened and tested. So they spent 40 years. We're nearing the end of the journey, and you get the sense at the very end that they're ready to enter the land.
I just want to ask, because later on in the book of Jeremiah, you know, it's Zacharti la chesed nurai lechtech acharai bamidbar. You know, this period of time is reflected with great nostalgia.
As well it should be. I think to me, the literary strength of the Torah is that it depicts events as they're unfolding. And so you're in the middle of things when you read Sefer Bamidbar. Jeremiah, writing hundreds of years later, is looking back and taking a snapshot, as it were, of the experience of our ancestors in the wilderness. We should never think that it was ever all bad. Certainly it was not all good. And so from a later generation, you know, the line that's often used in cultural studies is, it's a search for a usable past. For Jeremiah, the usable past was God's love in the wilderness.
Do you think it's also, you know, the fact that there were so many conflicts? I mean, we live in conflict. That's when we have the intensity of our lives. And when you move from an intense period to a less intense period, you kind of look back at it and you say, you know, isn't it great? I mean, we're talking about people who had their greatest accomplishments early on in their lives, you know, and here early on in the history of Israel are the greatest accomplishments. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Well, I don't know if it's the greatest accomplishments. I mean, I find it in my shul, for example.
That's the greatest.
That is a simply mind-boggling accomplishment. And like the Bamidbar, just showing up day after day is a kind of triumph. But I would say that, you know, I think that people, as they read this story, you know, they relate to that sense that they're complaining about the food and it's hard and it's a long journey and they're sweating and it's hot. And I think people relate to the way Bamidbar depicts life as grueling. But as Barry said a minute ago, you know, Jeremiah looks back afterwards. But you ask yourself as you search for that, in that great phrase, the usable past, Jeremiah is saying, well, what is the story that really matters? That the people were willing in their young love, I mean, it's a great line, you know, chesed ne'orayich, in your young love, you were willing to trust me and go on this journey and see what happens. We also have the idea that the people who were milumadim benisim, they were ochle man, right? They went through the desert and they were fed with miraculous food. They were wrapped in clouds of glory. And what's sort of astonishing in Jewish tradition is we make both of these claims. This was the generation of the expanded consciousness. This is the generation that was cared for by God in an unprecedented, really unnatural, you know, not the normal way of human beings live, but unnatural sort of way. Are they in the self same people who bitch about the food and who are always unhappy and who have lots of conflicts? And by the way, folks, that's reality. You know, you can have lots and lots of blessings and lots of conflicts at the same time.
This book is a book with a lot of movement, a lot of, you know, conflicts. We're going to move into the Sefer Dvarim, which is essentially a static book. It's a book of speeches and valedictories. So we want to anticipate a very significant shift in tone from Bamidbar to Dvarim, as we did from Vayikra to Bamidbar. Vayikra was also a significantly static book. And you know, we want to just comment on the fact that Bamidbar ends with the verse that says, Ela mitzvot v'mishpatim asher tzivad Nabi Yad Moshe. These are the laws and the commandments that the Lord enjoined upon Israelites through Moses. Barvot Moab al Yerden Yericho, on the steps of Moab at the Jordan near Jericho. Interesting. I mean, it may not be that significant, although it may be greatly significant, because the book of Vayikra essentially ends with telling us these are the mitzvot that God gave to Moshe on Mount Sinai. So my question really is, you know, does Revelation, the character of Revelation, change from place to place? And is it too much of a springboard to say that Revelation has a different quality in different geographies and different settings and different temporal spaces?
What's striking is the scene of Vayikra is Sinai. They're right by Sinai. So the book naturally ends, this is what you got at Sinai. The scene at the end of Sefer Bamidbar is Arvod Moav, and God is still revealing to us there. And I think perhaps the message is that God is with us, but we have to be open to his message.
Yeah, but is the character of Revelation different at a mountain as it is in the plains?
I would say yes. And I think, you know, Barry said a minute ago, it's a note of triumph. And there certainly is a note of triumph. At the same time, the very final things that happen here in Bamidbar, I take to be kind of grim. That is to say, we get the message about the cities of refuge. Okay, you're about to enter this. You're about to enter the land, and I've told you these mitzvot, which explain how you should behave. By the way, you're going into a place. There's going to be violent conflict. People are going to die, and some people are going to try to avenge. And there's going to be accidents, and there's going to be vengeance. And you need a method for dealing with that kind of conflict. There's the continuing conflict over the family of Tzlofad ben Hefer, his daughters who want to maintain their ancestral heritage, and their cousins who don't want to let them marry into another tribe because they'll lose the land. And that strikes me also as a kind of a... I realize the land is important, and I don't mean to suggest that inheriting the land is somehow unseemly, but there's something greedy about that passage. I want the land. No, I want the land. And to me, the very, very ends, and then there's the matter of Reuven and God, which we'll talk about in a second, but there's a way in which Bamidbar ends, like, okay, ladies and gentlemen, you've been through the desert, God's been feeding you in manna, wrapping you in clouds of glory. This is about to get difficult.
So I want to suggest a slightly different vantage point. As Jeremy well said about the cities of refuge, they do bespeak violence that will become an encounter with the land. But on the other hand, the cities of refuge are a means to purify the land from the violence. The dispute between Benot Slovchad and their cousins is a means to make sure that as they enter the land, everyone is going to know where they are supposed to go. The land is important, and I see it as a means to preserve the land for everybody, and not just the jealous working out of cousins wondering if perhaps the daughters are getting away with more than they should.
You know, it strikes me as we're talking about this that Bamidbar is a political book, a book with politics. Dvarim is a theological book. We have Bamidbar, which is politics, Dvarim, which is theology. And you know, that is like such a change in tone, and we're anticipating it for next week, obviously, but it's significant to reflect on the fact that the messiness of Bamidbar, the violence that we're talking about, and the different kinds of conflicts, family conflicts, tribal conflicts, they all have to be resolved in some political framework. Whereas in Dvarim, it's spoken of in simply theoretical terms.
Right, and Dvarim also harkens back to the very beginning of the Torah, which it begins with words, and Dvarim is all words.
Yeah, I would say that we were talking a little bit before the show here, before we went on air with the show, that, you know, Bamidbar ends, and it clearly is an end, as was the case for Vayikra as well. in a different way, Shmot, but you make this summation kind of statement. These are the mitzvot which God has given us, period. And you just think for a moment in the history of Judaism as it is developing and the Bible as it's being revealed piece by piece. Can you imagine if this was the end of the Bible? Can you imagine if B'Midbar was the end of the Bible? You're at the edge of the land, and think of all of the enormous powerful innovations in the way in which Devarim stamps our Judaism, which it doesn't appear to be the same sort of book exactly as Eliot said. It's got a different focus. Devarim is a book for Torah students. Devarim is a book for those who sit in the Beit Midrash and reflect on the meaning of Jewish behavior and Jewish life. And B'Midbar is more of a storybook.
So the statement of Devarim then is that the people are not yet ready to enter the land, which we thought at the end of B'Midbar, that they need both a review, which is the repetition that we find from the different casting of stories we're familiar with, and also the new, as you had indicated in our conversation before the show about the Shema Yisrael, certainly one of the glorious statements in Sefer Devarim, that as we get ready, we need to find a way to combine the old with the new so that we can take the next step.
So let's just zero in on a couple of pieces in Matot Maaseh. Where should we start? Maybe
how about Reuven and Gad, because they come to near the end of the journey, and Reuven, the tribes of Reuven and Gad, and half of the tribe of Menashe, or perhaps Chatzi Shevet Menashe might mean either half the tribe of Menashe or the half tribe, like as if there's a sub tribe, which it kind of is, the sub tribe of Yosef. They say, man, you know, we are a cattle-raising people, and this land over in contemporary Jordan, just, you know, maybe like around the Golan Heights or something like that, or around the other side of the Dead Sea, we've got a lot of grazing ground. We would really prefer to stay here and not enter into the land of Israel proper, across the Jordan and the across that geographical boundary into land of Israel proper. And to me, this is a tremendously interesting passage. Moshe says to them, well, all right, you can leave your families and your livestock here, but you have to go ahead as chalutzim, which, you know, the modern use of chalutz is adapted from here. You have to be the troops at the front of the battle on that behalf of the whole people, and then you can return. I think that there's a way in which Reuven and Gad and half of Menashe are like, you know, a failure of nerve and a failure of vision. They are in too much oriented towards the wealth that they hold in the course of livestock, and they don't really want to be part of this special land. The money, you know, the affluence that they can have in the diaspora, so to speak, or the Ever HaYarden, is enough to sap their enthusiasm for really coming into the promised land.
Perhaps they speak for a failure of imagination. Things are so good for them where they are right now, they can't imagine it being any better. And in fact, what they seem to be saying is that the promised land holds no promise for us. We're happy where we are.
They're archetypal secessionists. They want to secede from the Union, basically.
John Calhoun, I think, was from the tribe of Reuven.
Reuven, yeah.
But it only underscores the craft and the political genius of later kings like David, who would be able to cobble the tribes together as one federation of tribes.
That was the original federation,
the Federation of Tribes. So we have this moment where there is internal conflict within Israel, and not all of Israel is sharing the fate. They're not leaping into solidarity with each other.
Well, that's beautiful and really challenging. Is Rav Soloveitchik said in the essay Kol Dod Yidofek, there are two kinds of covenants of Israel: a covenant of fate and a covenant of destiny. Brit Goral, covenant of fate; Brit Yehud, a covenant of our goal and destiny. And the Brit Yehud, the destiny, is the world that we want to build, what we want the relationship of humanity and God to be. And the Brit Goral is that what befalls one of us will befall us all. And he wrote that in the 1960s, in the shadow of the Shoah and the birth of the State of Israel. And, you know, one might be a little bit fancy and say one of them is the breed of Auschwitz, and one is the breed of Zionism, one is the breed of suffering, and one is the breed of what we're trying to build. And Reuven and Gad at a certain point seem to be at arm's length to the breed of fate. They're like, you know what? All right, we'll fight for you, but we are holding the fate of our brethren at arm's length.
It's interesting. I mean, we are using this as a story, perhaps, you know, not to shoehorn too much into it, but we are in a moment of conflict, tension within the Jewish people. A lot of people writing now and talking about the fact that the oneness of the Jewish people is not everlasting. It's in terrible stress right now for lots and lots of different reasons. And here you have a story where there was resolution to this. There was an attempt to resolve this kind of strife among Israel. So we have other things to reflect on in this parsha. I love to refer to the Maaseh B'nai Israel, the journey, and we reflect on journey as the master metaphor of life. All of our chanichim, our campers, they're on a different kind of journey in their development. The fact that the Torah lists all of these things is encodes an idea of relationship in the people, that there is a certain idea of God loving the people, and therefore at every single point all of these places are mentioned.
So it reminds me of the comment that Rashi makes at the beginning of the parsha, where he says that the census is a form of God's love, a demonstration of God's love for us, and the detailing here of the Masa'ot is a similar expression of God's love for the people. That even though he decreed that we would have to go through all these various misadventures, shall we say, in the wilderness, God took care of that. These 42 way stations, we weren't spending a few days here, a few days there. We spent a lot of time moving at the beginning, a lot of time moving at the end, but most of the time we were sedentary. We had a chance to catch our breath. And that what's striking then, I think, according to Rashi, is that B'Midbar becomes a book about God's love for us, and we have to find that love in these pages.
How do we find that love in these pages?
Find it for the Rabbi Kamenowski.
Well, I would say that look, let's talk about the relationship. The relationship is a complicated relationship, and love is complicated. Love is, it's not just Ahava Rabba Ahavtanu, God loved us with a great love, and it's not just Ahavat Olam, the eternal love. It's a love that makes demands on us. It's a love that challenges us. It pushes us to the limit. Israel, B'nai Israel, terrified by the things that are taking place in this journey. Lots of things can happen that are terrible within the context of a relationship that terrify you.
On a theological level, I would say that one of the major questions in the history of Jewish theology has been about God static or God ever-changing.
Sure.
And Maimonides is certainly the avatar of God is static. God is a metaphysical principle, doesn't change based on what happens to the people on earth. It would be bizarre, you know, Rambam thinks, for a bunch of people to complain about food and God says, that's it, I'm going to kill you. That's just not the God of the cosmos. On the other hand, the Bible, you know, without being irreverent here, you say sometimes God is just like a big, gigantic person, just a really, really big, gigantic-sized person who has the same impulses that we have, who changes all the time. And this is the love story of B'Midbar, which, as you referred to, Elliot, is the in the poetic version of Yirmiyahu, the people follow God into the desert. They don't know what's going to be. They don't have any reason except love and trust to feel like it's going to be okay. And the journey's hard. And sometimes I want to divorce you, and sometimes you want to divorce me. And they go through a lot of pain and strife. And so the love that endures You know, if you had a couple came to you, you know, to get married, or you're talking to a couple who've been married, and you ask them about how they resolve conflict, and they say, "Well, we never have any conflict," you'd say, I don't believe you," or something like that. And Bamidbar is the love that endures despite and through the conflict, not the absence of conflict.
The high intensity conflict, the low intensity conflicts, and everything in between, and you know, the relationship is a complicated relationship. I'm not sure we would want to use this relationship as the paradigm for all marital relationships.
No, but it still works pretty well as a paradigm for the relationship between God and Israel.
Right. Because that's what it is. And you know, again, just casting just a line to the Book of Dvarim, it seems that in the Book of Dvarim, the relationship gets resolved because at least it gets crystallized in a few salient verses. V'ahavta et Hashem Elohecha, Ahavat Hashem is a major theme running throughout the whole book. And so here we kind of package and bracket off all of the difficulties in God's relationship with Israel and move to you know, a new place where the love of God in Israel can actually be manifest in things like mitzvah and things like, you know, the way we are to walk with God, walk behind God.
To make the love endure, despite all the pain, you have to be yourself. Like, you have to fundamentally, and this is true in human relationships, this is true in marriages, this is true in the relationship between God and Israel, you have to somehow hang on to that best version of yourself. And I'm reminded of a great verse in the Haftarah in Jeremiah. These are the Haftarot of the Tzlata de Puranuta, the Haftarot of rebuke before Tisha B'Av. And one of the lines is, Anochi nitatich sorech, sorech kula zera emet. I planted you as a vine that was totally true and honest and terrific. Ve'ech nehefach li surei gefen nochria. And how have you become a foreign vine? Like, I planted the vineyard with Zera Emet. I trusted you. We were worthy. But you have become Gefen Nochria. You've become somebody else. And for the love to endure, you have to be Zera Emet. You have to be the true and honest self. And watch yourself that you not become somebody else.
Relationships change you, though. And how could they not become something else throughout 40 years of death, destruction, conflict, questions of leadership, and all the messy politics of life?
Well, sure, I would say that people change, but if you change and develop as yourself, and we all know people who you can see that the pattern, but we also know people who say they look at their spouse and they go, "I don't recognize you anymore." Yeah. And so that's what God through Jeremiah is saying, is I don't even recognize you anymore. I don't know who you are.
The relationship can simply not exist anymore.
Yeah.
And that is actually the terrifying under theme of the Torah, that God will hide his face, God will abandon Israel, which is how Bamidbar Devarim kind of ends on this note, the possibility of abandonment, the rupture of relationship. But we don't want to rupture the relationship. We want to put it all together. We want to kind of end this book, end Bamidbar, and end our podcast on a higher note.
And the first month of camp.
And the first month of camp. We have many, many of our chanichim going home after the first month, and they certainly had great, exciting experiences here. We want to wish them a wonderful rest of the summer, and to the rest of the camp, a beautiful Shabbat. Any kind of concluding words here?
Sure. I think that, again, it's worth reiterating that at the very end, the Israel has made it through the 40 years with God. God had expressed moments when he wanted to abandon the Israelites. The Israelites expressed moments when they wanted to abandon God. But at the end, they stay together. And that's a powerful statement, that I think what the difference between personal love and covenantal love is that covenantal love cannot be broken. that you cannot abandon the one that you love when hardship or a difference in seeing comes to you, because that bond is unbreakable.
It's eternal. And on that note, we wish...
Yeah, I was going to say, we're going to miss our chanichim who are going home. We're going to look forward to meeting your parents at visiting day, Yom Orchim. But we're going to miss you guys, and we'll hope to see you next year.
We want to wish everyone who's staying for the second month, and our whole cast of staff, and all of the listeners who are attentively listening to our podcast or our broadcast in camp and around the world.
And all the ships at sea.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. FM.